Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, this is Craig Garber. When I'm not interviewing world-class guitar players, I'm busy helping clients with their marketing. In fact, since March of 2000, I've helped over 300 clients in 108 different industries all over the world sell everything from $20 books to $5,000 seminar seats and everything in between. I even authored a marketing book called How to Make Maximum Money with Minimum Customers. And now, I'm giving away a free marketing strategy session to business owners who qualify. On this call, we'll discuss what's currently working in your business, specific sales and marketing problems you're struggling with, and I'll identify specific strategies you can use to overcome these problems and increase your cash flow. To find out if you qualify and to book your free marketing strategy session with me, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/marketing right now. Again, to book your free marketing strategy session with me, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/marketing right now. Thanks for listening. Now let's get on with the show. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber with Everyone Loves Guitar, and we've got a tremendous blues legacy with us today. It's an honor and a privilege to have Bob Margolin with us today. Bob's had the opportunity to play with and for two of the greatest blues artists of all time, Muddy Waters and Johnny Winter, of course. Bob's a Boston native and a three-time Grammy Award winner. He started playing guitar at age 15, and he immediately started performing in local rock and blues bands. At 24, in 1973, he was hired by Muddy Waters, and he toured all over the world with Muddy for the next 7 years. In 1975, they recorded Grammy Award-winning Muddy Waters' Woodstock album, which was Muddy's last album for Chess, which featured Paul Butterfield and Levon Helm, as well as Garth Hudson, those guys, of course, in the band. In 76, Muddy brought Bob with him to San Francisco to perform at the band's Last Waltz concert, which Martin Scorsese filmed for the classic concert film. Bob says, as it happened, only one camera was operating during our performance, zooming in or out, and since I was standing right next to Muddy, I was in every shot while he sang a powerful Manish Boy, which is probably one of my favorite, if not my favorite, Muddy Waters song. Bob also played on the four albums that Muddy recorded for Blue Sky Records that were produced by Johnny Winter, and with Johnny on his Nothing But the Blues album. Three of those albums won Grammy Awards. Bob left Muddy's band in 1980. He formed his own band, playing mostly up and down the East Coast. He appeared at the 1984 New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, joining the Fabulous Thunderbirds for a tribute to Muddy Waters, with Etta James singing and Taj Mahal and James Cotton opening. I mean, the names and the legacy here are just phenomenal. Bob's own band opened shows for Stevie Ray Vaughan, George Thorogood, Johnny Winter, and the Fabulous Thunderbirds. Between 89 and 93, Bob released three solo records, including Down in the Alley on Alligator Records in 93. He released his second album for Alligator called My Blues and My Guitar in 95, followed by 97's Up and In. Bob also appeared on a Kennedy Center tribute to Muddy Waters in 97, which featured Buddy Guy, Coco Taylor, John Hiatt, G.E. Smith, Peter Wolf, the guy who I think has one of the greatest voices ever in the history of music, Nick Cravanides, Keb Moe, Big Bill Morganfield, Robert Lockwood Jr., Charlie Musselwhite, Barry Goldberg, and Johnny Johnson. And there was a DVD of that concert called A Tribute to Muddy Waters, King of the Blues. That was released the following year in 98. Also in 97, Bob wrote and was featured in the instructional video Muddy Waters Guitar Style for Starlick's video. And he's a founding partner in the Viztone label group, which was formed in 2007. In 2016, Bob won two Blues Blast magazine awards, one of them for Best Male Blues Artist and one for Best Traditional Blues Album for his album that was released at the time called My Road. In 2013, he was also nominated for the Blues Foundation's Blues Music Award for Traditional Male Blues Artist. He's won a Blues Music Awards for guitar in 2008 and also in 2005. He's won numerous W.C. Handy Blues Music Awards for his playing. He's a KBA Award recipient for journalism, and that's because in the early 90s, Bob started a second career as a music writer. And in 2011, he released a book featuring the best of his writing called Steady Rollin', which was blues stories, snapshots, and intentional blues fiction. He's produced albums for numerous artists, including Muddy's son, Big Bill Morganfield, Candy Kane, Pine Top Perkins, Mark
Mac Arnold, sorry about that, and Rabson, and he's also produced and consulted on reissues of Muddy Waters recordings for the Blue Sky label for Sony Legacy. Bob, I really appreciate your time coming here, and what a legacy you have here.
Well, I mostly felt like my life was flashing before my eyes when you said all that. A couple of corrections. I don't have any Grammy Awards. Mm. I've played on albums that have made them, but I know I never wrote that anywhere.
I wonder where I got that from. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's all right. Grammys have their upsides and their downsides, I guess.
I'm sure, man.
But I don't have any myself for them, although the My Road album did. You must have had a little earlier biography than the one that I have up there right now, because I did get last year in 2017 a Blues Music Award, the one I was nominated for in 2013. I did win this Best Traditional Blues Male Artist. That was awesome. Last year. And I just came back from the Blues Music Awards that were in Memphis last week, and associated events for that. And that's always fun because it really feels like blues music is a big deal in Memphis when all the blues people are around, the musicians and the people that love it and the people that are in the business, all hanging out together, having big parties all over the place.
Yeah, I saw a couple of guys that I know, that posted some of that stuff on Facebook. You know Sean Chambers?
Yeah, sure do.
Yeah, Sean, I saw him. He just played at, do you know Skipper's down here in Tampa?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was just at Skipper's a couple of weeks ago. We live like 5 minutes from there, so I came there, hung out with him a little bit, and I've known him and his music for quite some time. So he posted a bunch of music. It seemed like a really cool time in Memphis. Hey, at age 24, you got hooked up with Muddy. How did this all come about?
Well, in the 2 or 3 years before that, I had been in bands that opened shows for Muddy, and he saw that I was trying to play what he called old school Chicago blues. Naturally, the band I was in didn't play any Muddy Waters songs on a show with him. But we were playing songs by Jimmy Rogers and Elmore James and Sonny Boy Williamson and Little Walter, a lot of the legends that were Muddy's peers. And I really did love that music more than any other kind, and Muddy was my favorite musician. So it was a thrill to open shows for him and then get to know him, and then a bigger thrill to have him be encouraging. And then one time in August 1973, I went down to see him on the first night of Five Nights at a club in Boston, and I was the first one that walked into the place. And I immediately saw the harmonica player, who told me that Muddy had fired a guitar player the night before. And he said, "Oh, good, wait here." And a minute later, Muddy came out and said, "Oh, good, bring a guitar to my hotel tomorrow." And I mean, he just presumed that I would want to do it if I had the chance to. But that's certainly a crossroads moment. Of course I wanted to do it. It was more than I would ever dare dream about.
What was going through your mind? What a tremendous validation of all the work you've done till that point. But what was going through the, how are you feeling, I guess, if you could even remember, at that moment?
I felt it was a great opportunity for the future, and to learn like an apprentice to a master, rather than the conventional ways that people learn things these days. It was, and I could see about everything that's happened ever since, including no Grammy Awards. But I could really see what it would mean to do that. Now, on the one hand, I was, I was 24 years old, and that would be prime time for making my own mark in the world. But Muddy was in his late 50s at the time I joined the band. I didn't know how long he was going to be out there. And so I went to the hotel. Muddy said, play the guitar, and I did, and I had him scoped out pretty good. I played just a nasty old slow blues and E, like the kind of thing that he would have played if somebody put a guitar in his hand and said, play it. And I did that. But then he started singing along with what I was playing. Mm. And that was certainly the biggest musical thrill that I had at that point.
What guitar were you playing?
I had a white SG at the time with P90 pickups on it.
Which is a great blues guitar, to say the least. So you obviously said, okay, you're on board, or you're hired, or, you know, great, you want to come out with us, or something like that?
Well, he gave it a try, but as of that point, I was in the band, and he called his drummer, Willie Smith, and Willie Big Eyes Smith, and told him, and Willie smiled and stuck out his hand, said, welcome to the club.
Awesome.
Which was very gracious. Yeah, go ahead.
No, I apologize. Go ahead.
Well, it started me on the road that I'm still riding, I think. I like to do my own original songs. Years where I've played old bar band type of gigs, all the way up to festivals, but just playing blues and rock and roll and rhythm and blues, rockabilly music with all kinds of people have been really important to me. But the old school Chicago blues, that's still my favorite. I like to do them all, and I still want to honor Muddy while I do my own music, and why can't I do all of them?
Sure. What would you think the most important things you learned from Muddy, either musically, business-wise, or just life-wise?
Well, musically, he had a feel that is even farther behind the beat than most blues players. Just have a little hesitation, just something held back in their timing. You play a little bit behind the beat, kind of on the back edge of it rather than the front edge, which is more like military or country music or something. But on that back edge, it kind of subliminally makes you beg for the note to get there, and then when it does, it feels that much better, and it swings. But Muddy did that to even more of an extreme than most blues artists do. He had his own name for his own timing. He called it delay time. it was deliberate.
I was going to say,
it's probably something that he picked up in the Mississippi Delta when he was young, but that's the way he played. And very quickly found I better get with that, or else I won't be in the band long. Hmm. If I hit the note before everybody else does, I'm leading them to speed up, which would be wrong. So I had to quickly work on that a little bit. It didn't take long, and it wasn't that hard to do, and it was a nice habit to pick up. But His timing was fairly important. Also, the way he led a band on stage by starting the song himself, and everybody could see what he would do and come right in, and usually by the second measure of the song or something. He had his own way of running the band, and I'd been in the band of somebody that had played with him earlier, a guy named Luther Snake Johnson.
Oh, yeah, I know that guy.
Do you really?
Yeah. He played in SG also.
At one time he did, yeah. But I was in his band from, I think, the end of 1971 to early 1972. And he ran his band the same way as Muddy. And by the way, there's a guitar player that must live in your area there in southern Florida named Mark Evangelos, that if you see him playing somewhere, go see him. He was in Luther's band before I was, and he's just a spectacular blues guitar player. Pretty good singer, too.
Mark Evangelos. I just wrote that down.
Yep, we're friends and we stay in touch.
Yeah, I think Luther Snake Johnson passed away young as well, didn't he?
In about 1975. But yeah. I still got a chance to introduce him to the newer guitar player in Muddy's band, guy that got in the band about 4 months after I did, whose name was also Luther Johnson. So at one point somewhere in Rhode Island in about 1974, I got to say, Luther Johnson, meet Luther Johnson.
That's pretty funny. Not something that happens every day. Any life lessons that you got from Muddy? Or just common, you know, what I call life, just common sense, you know, good old-fashioned common sense.
Let me tell you a story then. One time, Muddy was talking to the guys in the band, and he explained, you know, sometimes I'll take a gig on the road where we're not making as much money as we'd like to, and I'm not going to profit from it. But it'll pay for our hotels for a day, and sometimes I'm working for y'all. Mm-hmm. And he explained that, and I hadn't realized that at the time. I didn't know what the band's business was, how much they were making. I just know how much I was paid, and that was my only business. But one thing that Muddy said about that situation that stuck with me is, you can't make all the money all the time. And there's a lot of people that try to do that. You know, one could say that politically too.
Sure.
But or I would. However, as much as he wanted to make money and live well, Muddy Waters, a very deep person who most people just think is a musical force of nature, but was a deep human being as well, had said that you just can't, everything you want is not going to happen for you all the time.
What an important lesson that is as a young guy to hear that. It's almost like gives you permission in a sense, you know?
Well, it gives you permission to be a bad businessman, I guess.
Well, no, I mean, it gives you permission to, I mean, you have realistic expectations about
it is helpful. And I it's helpful to recognize it when somebody else is, coming at you in a greedy way, either socially or business-wise. But the advantage is knowing to do the right thing, and the right thing is not always what makes you the most money.
Right, right.
That's an important lesson from it. Hmm. On the other hand, there's plenty of situations where just making a living is hard for a lot of musicians. I've had my ups and downs too with that, and I generally follow my heart, and sometimes that leads to a good place financially, sometimes it doesn't, but at the end of the day, in the end of my life, I'll be able to say, well, I followed my heart and had some big thrills.
Which is really important when you're looking in the mirror.
Well, it's been a long time since the mirror was my friend.
I hear
or a
that,
camera
man.
Either.
I hear that. I guess same question about your relationship with Johnny Winter. What was the, you know, maybe a cool experience that you had with Johnny, and what was the most important thing that Johnny taught you about music or business or life or playing the blues?
Well, people ask me what he was like, because he was another apparent force of nature, very, very powerful singer and guitar player and band leader, very active on stage, and I became a fan of his the first time that, as soon as he started to get well known in about 1967 or 8 or so, I really liked what he was doing. Maybe it was 1969 his first album came out, and he played at Woodstock and everything, and I did see him back then in Boston, and took a really nice picture of him back then that I still have. Had Tommy Shannon on the bass, who later played with Stevie Vaughan.
Yeah, I remember that band. What a great band that was.
Yeah, it certainly was. And people would ask me, you know, when they knew that I was working. Actually, Johnny was working with Muddy, and that was my connection to him. But we did become friends, and I would spend time with him or go to his shows and sit in, or aside from the Muddy things that we did together. And he was just another very enthusiastic musician who wanted to share it with another one. I would go to his apartment in New York sometimes, and he would just play records for me over and over. Old Library of Congress country blues records thing. His record collection went really deep, and he knew about a lot of music, and he incorporated it into his own playing too. But he was really powerful. I'm working on a new album right now where I decided to do a lot of the things that I do, write some original songs and perform them, but then also go back and the cover songs would not just be songs that I like that I think I could do well or bring something new to, but songs by some of the people that I worked with over the years that aren't around anymore. And one of them was a Johnny Winter song that I kind of chose. And a lot of the reason I chose it is because the first night that I really got together with Johnny, when we were setting up a studio for Muddy's Heart Again record, he and I hung out afterwards and played guitars a little bit, and he had a guitar that was in open G tuning, and he sang his own song Dallas, which was exciting for me, because I guess say 7 years before that I was at home listening to that song when I was 20 or so and going, oh my God, this is incredible. This guy takes the country blues and plays it with his own voice and energy and power. And I was very excited by it. And then suddenly there we were jamming on that song. It was also funny because he kept messing up the words.
Too, really?
He'd stop and go, wait a minute, that's not right. But when I thought of the, when I was trying to think of songs that would be good to record now, and I'm doing it myself at home, I'm going to play every note on the album. I thought of that one. I said, yes, that's a great choice. And I went and got a National Steel guitar that I have and just went right in, listened to him a couple of times and thought about some of the other, well, licks for that kind of song. I know the music to it is a lot like Robert Johnson's Terraplane Blues. And I had also... Muddy Waters had heard me messing around with that in a dressing room once, and we got on stage. And said, I heard you playing Terraplane in the dressing room. You play it, I'll sing it.
Oh.
And we that was a surprise, but it was a real thrill for me. But so this, all of those situations, open G tuning on a on a National Steel guitar with a slide. I've really wanted to get one in there, and I hope I did a nice version of it. I hope people will smile when they hear it, and I'd like to think it would please Johnny to know that I did that.
When is that record coming out?
It's still being recorded now. I'm going to record a few more songs and then decide which ones I like best, and then... If I need help mixing it, I'll do that. But I'm starting to get a few mixes that I really like, so I may just at the end of it say, "Hey, this is all mine. Just have it mastered, manufactured, and put out on the Viztone label group, which is I'm a founding partner in that." So
let's talk about
do it that way.
Let's talk about that for a minute. What prompted you to start a record company?
Well, in 2006, I was doing actually the same thing as what I'm doing right now, which is to make an album by myself at home. And when it was ready to go, a friend of mine said, I can help you put that out, and we started a so we kind of began to make those arrangements. And right at that time, a friend of mine from Boston, Richard Rosenblatt, a fine harmonica player, but he also had been the founder and creator of Tone Cool Records in from 1988 on, which gave us the first albums by Susan Tedeschi and then the first ones by the North Mississippi All-Stars.
Mm.
And but he had sold that company, and he sent around an email to his friends saying, anybody need a good harp player or a used record company executive? And yes, we did, because me and my friend didn't know how to didn't know the record business, and he did. And of course, at that time, say 10 years ago, things were changing big time. It was really obvious downloads were going to be a big deal, and by the time downloads got here, streaming was already a big deal. You don't have to own any music anymore. It can all be up in the cloud. But for some people, that's the way it is. And it's very convenient to have a smartphone that will actually play music back that can sound pretty good depending on what you put into it.
Sure. Sure. So you founded that label just because you wanted to take advantage or have more control over the current distribution of music, basically?
Well, I wanted to get my own album out some way. That's what started it. And when we did that, we realized that we could do this for other people too. And so we began more and more of them. And now I think it's been about 12 years and considerably more than 100 albums. And I'm kind of, my job with the label is, I guess, what they would call artist and repertoire, A&R. If I hear somebody I like, or if somebody sends us some music, I give it a good critical listen, and if we like it, we'll put it out in a partnership with other musicians rather than the model of a conventional record company, which is usually not very good for the artist. If somebody gets to be a millionaire, you bet somebody else got to be a multimillionaire.
Yeah.
In the old business model of it. This is more of a partnership where if we put out a lot of records without owning their publishing, without owning their masters or anything, charge a little bit for our services with a professional distributor and professional publicity. It's a good model, and we've put out some fine albums, and the value of Vistone is the quality of the music of its artists. It gets to the point now where I guess we're branded. If a DJ or a journalist or a radio person get something from Vistone, they have an idea that it's probably going to be pretty good and it's worth taking a listen to it.
So your job or Vistone's function is distribution, kind of like probably mentoring and PR.
Well, no, the mentoring part really isn't in there officially, in that we don't tell anybody what to record or, you know, give them input. If they hand us what they did and we like it, then we'll put it out. Sometimes things that we've been on the fence about do really well. Sometimes we reject something and it goes on to do really well itself for whoever does put it out. And then sometimes an album we put out, say, well, this isn't really too bluesy or anything, but we think a blues audience might like it. And then that kind of thing happens. It's like most endeavors of that sort. You put out something you like and hope it will be successful. But we're not going to get rich off of any one artist. But if we have a bunch of them and they continue to, and their music continues to sell our little part of it over the course of a lot of artists, will add up to something.
Sure. The record that it's in the oven, is that what you're most excited about that you're working on now?
That's exactly right. Sometimes when I'm at home and working on it, I learned a lot about myself doing this record too, as well as learning a lot about recording and playing. There's really wonderful home equipment now that will work well. A professional studio engineer I know said, "Whoever thought we would be recording on office equipment?"
Yeah,
you know, compared to old analog tape recorders and music that was made, musical equipment and mixing boards that were made by people that were artistic in the equipment that they made as well. But that's the way it is these days. I'm able to do this on a laptop, and then we'll get it. I'll definitely get it mastered by a good professional and put it out. If I find I just don't like my own mixes, then I will go to my friend that's worked on most of my albums and either get advice or say, this one's too much for me. I'll give you the sound files, and well, let's put it together with both of us. But so far, some of them are starting to come together well enough so that I think I want to put them out as they are and just have it be a pure expression of myself, for better or for worse.
That's great, man. I'm really happy for you that you're doing that. You mentioned, Bob, you've learned a lot about yourself during this process. What are some things that you've learned about yourself?
Well, when I make this kind of music, it's just as exciting as being on stage, is sitting in a room in my house with some pretty good studio monitors in front of me, and but small ones, just desktop size, and a laptop and a professional interface to put the microphones or plug in an instrument directly if I want to. And it really gives me the same kind of buzz that I get playing live. It's exciting. It's thrilling to try and conceive a part for a song and play along with a background part that I've done and feel the new part develop. I enjoy doing it that way. Sometimes I sit down, have no idea what I'm going to play, and have a happy mistake. I mean, a happy accident.
Happy accident,
It does. One time I had really worked a long time on one song that had a lot of parts, a lot of tracks to it, and then I said, I need to just play some blues, and I just plugged in a guitar and recorded it, and the one guitar part came out fine. Then I wrote a song that seemed to go with the music and just sang it over it. And so it was, the whole thing was done in not much longer than it took to actually play it. But and then some of them just work for hours remixing or saying, oh, that vocal isn't good. I'm taking my time doing it. I've been working on it when I can for a few months now. And it's really interesting to leave it alone for a while, not think about it, not listen to it, and come back a week later. And you hear something that I hear something I didn't like before that now sounds fine, or something, or the opposite, makes me go, what was I thinking? I was going to let that go and let me do that again, or throw that song away.
So it's been a really refreshing and fun experience for you, it sounds like.
Yeah. And so far, I've only played a couple of tracks for one musician friend or for my wife at home. My dogs don't seem to care for it.
Hopefully they're not the standard of comparison for all your music. You'll be all right.
I did have a situation in 2006 when I was recording an album. I had an instrumental that I wanted to do, and I put down a couple of basic tracks and started putting a guitar part over it. And we had a dog that was about 17 years old, a border collie that we had had since she was a year and a half old. And she was near the end of her life, and she'd been deaf for about 10 years. But in the room where I was recording, with an amplifier, an electric guitar is a louder sound than she would encounter at home in a house. And I guess she must have been able to hear something, because she would just lay right in front of that amplifier, right next to the microphone that was recording it. And probably could hear or feel some of the music there. So I just kept adding guitar parts, because every time I'd finish one, she'd go, more. And so that was what I did a long time ago for that sweet dog, and I miss her.
Yeah, man, I know that's like, I have a dog that's on her way out. It's kind of sad. when you lose an animal, man. Really, really a bummer. You're originally from Boston. What was your childhood like growing up?
Oh, I was lucky. I had parents that loved each other and loved me and took care of me well and set good example for me. And I had a easy, relatively sheltered childhood. No traumas that shape a lot of people's lives in reaction to them. I kind of grew up thinking that I could do anything that I tried to do or wanted to do, or was able to find that opportunity. Some things happen by luck, and like getting into Muddy's band was certainly a crossroads moment for me. But on the one hand, I loved that music and had been playing it for a few years as well as I could, and was kind of prepared to do the job because I'd been in Luther's band and kind of knew how the band would be run musically. But on the other hand, I came in right when he had fired somebody. And on the third hand, I was there because I was just a big fan of Muddy and his music, and I was going to be sitting right in front of that band every night that they were playing that I wasn't.
You mentioned that you were probably a little sheltered. When you came into Muddy's band, you were a young kid.
No, I was 24 years old. That's almost old enough to start to get gray hair.
That's young, man. Did he like recognize that you were a little green and kind of take you under his wing, or what was the vibe like as far, or what was that experience like for you as far as, you know, you having been a little sheltered and then like starting to learn the ways of the world?
Well, I didn't start to learn them in Muddy's band. I was 24 by that age. I'd been around a little bit. I've been playing in bands and playing in bars, and I was hardly sheltered by that time.
Okay.
But it was, you know, maybe it wasn't until I was in high school that I realized that not everybody came from as happy a home as I did. Some people's parents got divorced. God knows what happened behind closed doors. But you know, we're rough on people, but those things weren't rough on me, mostly.
You said a comment. You said, I was lucky because I had parents who loved each other. I've actually never heard that. And I was thinking about it from my own dynamic. I have a really pretty good relationship with my wife, and I hope that somehow is something my kids recognize and they're later that, you know, I was lucky that I had parents who loved each other. I've never heard that. That was really a real nice to hear, and a good, great tribute to your folks.
It is a nice thing to experience, and unfortunately a lot of people don't.
Yeah, for sure, man. Was playing guitar your original dream as a kid, or were you planning on becoming something else originally when you grew up?
I was very interested in cartooning when I was about 10 or 11 years old. And I guess when I was about 12, during the summers, I took some lessons at an art school where most people in there were college age. And I was about 12, but I was trying to learn and I was interested in it, but I wasn't thinking about a profession yet. But I started playing guitar when I was 15, really fell into it deep, and by the time I was 16, I started to get into bands, and I knew I wanted to do that, but I didn't expect I'd necessarily be lucky enough to get to do it as a career.
Sure. Were you drawn to blues right away when you started playing?
Not immediately. I heard what was on the radio, but I do remember that I always liked the bluesier songs that I heard. And so when I began to, I really started playing guitar because of Chuck Berry. And when I started to try and figure out his notes. He was playing what we call double stops, two notes at a time, very much, more than other guitar players did. It was kind of his signature style of guitar playing. And I realized that if you just played one of the notes at a time, you would have the blues scale.
Hmm.
And I kind of followed the path of Chuck Berry's inspiration back to Muddy. Muddy Waters helped Chuck Berry get his recording contract with Chess Records. And ironically, rock and rollers make a lot more money than blues people do.
Oh, yeah.
But some of those rock people would really try and help people like Muddy, have him open shows for them and try and shine a light on them. And Johnny Winter really did that. Since we're thinking about him and talking about him, he, after Muddy was through with Chess Records, Johnny recorded Muddy for his own label and tried to use his own fame as well as all the musical and producing skill he had already acquired to do the best he could with Muddy, and it was a pretty successful and famous partnership.
Yeah, that sure was, man. And man, that was some good music. So
it was a thrill to be involved in it.
You're a bit of a dichotomy in that, like, you came from this very healthy upbringing and you've been passionate about the blues your whole life. And it always seems that, like, guys that are specifically devoted to blues, you know, there's some source of pain or emotions that are really at the heart of their playing and maybe even at the core of their soul in some cases. And I was curious if for you anyway, in being a blues guy, are there things that you're exercising or working out through your guitar in playing blues?
Well, everybody that starts to grow up eventually finds himself on the battlefield of romance or just going through life trying to do things and being obstructed. And that's bluesy enough. We all have our own stories. And I can't say that I was a downtrodden person or anything and tried to play blues to crawl out of that. I was just originally attracted to the power, depth, and sensuality in the music. And as I got deeper, I think my playing did too, or I hope it did.
Oh yeah, man, you're a very soulful player, man. And I like what you just said, the power, depth, and what was the last thing you said? And the power, depth, and the functionality of it?
Sensuality.
Sensuality, yeah. I thought that was a pretty deep statement of it.
It feels good.
Yeah, man, it feels great. If you could go back and give advice to younger Bob Margolin, what advice would you have given to yourself, let's say in your 20s or 30s?
Well, I thought that I had a highly developed sense of right and wrong, and I would, if I thought somebody or a situation was messing with me or something, I would get angry. But over the course of years and with the help of a lot of good friends and my wife, I've tried to learn that it's more important to be kind than right.
Yeah, man, ain't that the truth?
Just because you're right about something doesn't mean you can just go off on somebody else. Well, you can, but it doesn't mean that you should. Sometimes it's better to try and be kind and learn from something and pick your battles.
Yeah, man, that's a great thing you learn as you get old. You kind of realize how much you're responsible for your own stress, and you say, you know, I don't need to do this. So let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What's your go-to guitar right now, and maybe what other guitars would round out your top players?
I have a very old Telecaster that owns me.
Yeah, that's a beautiful guitar, man. Tell me about it.
Well, I always wanted a Telecaster. I just thought it was the ultimate guitar, but never found the right one. Boy, did I find the wrong one in the 1970s. I'd had a couple of guitars stolen, and I said, that's it, no more nice guitars. I went to a pawn shop and bought a Telecaster for $150. And it was a Fender Telecaster, but it had a really harsh sound to it. And, you know, it sent people running out of the room, including me. And I said, okay, I better get something good. And found some 50s Fenders around the time that I was in Muddy's band and a little bit before it. But and I like Gibson guitars, too. I have a new gold top that I bought in 1999. But this Telecaster, I saw it in a music store in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1991. And a friend of mine, I fell in love with it, but a friend of mine bought it. I said, well, if you ever decide you want to sell it, please tell me. And about a year later, he did. Mm. And I've had it ever since. And but more and more, especially in the last 5 or 6 years or so, I've been just playing that Telecaster. Just everything about it seems right. It hardly ever breaks, and it doesn't break strings, and it stays in tune, and it sounds good, and it looks like exactly what it is, which is an early 50s Telecaster.
Butterscotch with the black guard?
Yep.
Yeah, man. That's
okay. I think the pick guard on it is not is a part that was put on later, probably in the 80s or something. But a lot of the parts of it are original. I think the electronics and the neck, and maybe or maybe not the body, probably the body. But functionally, it's an old Telecaster, and it just works good for any style of music or whatever I'm feeling. That guitar will do it, and probably a lot more than I can do with it.
So you got your 50s Tele, you got a sort of modern day gold topless Paul. Anything
yeah,
else?
Those are the main electric guitars that I have now. When I was younger, I did not realize that if I bought a new guitar, I could keep the old one. I literally, it didn't occur to me to have more than one or two guitars until after the 70s. Well into the 80s, maybe. I already had the ones I liked, but as I began to, I actually sold a couple of 1956 guitars that I had and played in Muddy's band to get enough money to make the last album I made, which is the opposite of approach from the homemade one that I'm doing now. I got a producer and an engineer and a studio, paid my band well, paid a publicist well, spent a lot of money on it. I sold a couple of guitars that I loved, but I wasn't playing them anymore. And I thought they could do better for me that way. And so I made a pretty good amount of money and was able to spend it on the production of that album that came out in early 2016 called My Road. And I'm happy with the album and happy that I did all that. It was a learning experience, and the album raised my profile a little bit and even got a lot of airplay, and people liked the songs when I play them live. But just a life lesson: after all that money that I got from those guitars, and I was going to spend it on making the album, in the middle of that summer I was overseas in Norway, and I called my wife and said, what's happened? She's like, oh, it's raining in the house.
Oh, God.
So new roof took half the money.
Mm. Wow. Well, that happens, so, as you know, man. It's always never a good time to need a new roof, man.
Yeah. Yeah, or your car can croak.
Yeah, or air conditioning or something like that, yeah, man.
Mm-hmm.
So that 50s Tele is the holy grail for you. Do you have an amp that for you is like your holy grail amp?
There's a company called Victoria out of Chicago. And when they started out, I was doing some writing for a magazine called Blues Review, and the guy that started building these amps said, I think I have an amplifier that's going to be very good for blues people. Can somebody try it out and maybe review it? And they sent it to me, and I fell in love with those amplifiers and had them, say, from the mid-90s on. But in 2006, I was going to Chicago to play on what turned out to be Coco Taylor's last album. And the guy said, let me bring you down this new design amplifier I have. And it's called a Victoria Regal amplifier. And it has a 15-inch speaker, and it runs in Class A. You can use two tubes in it, or one tube, and a large one or a small one. And it just has a sound that's so balanced and sweet. It fixes my mistakes, and it's just loud enough to be able to play it as long as there's not too many other people on stage. It's about 30 watts. But it just has a gorgeous sound and a spectacular tremolo and reverb in it, too. And I really just love that amplifier.
Man, you know what? That sounds exactly like the amp I have. It's a 30-watt Delta Blues PV amp, 15-inch speaker.
It looks like those PVs, but believe me, the circuits are pretty different.
Wow.
Those PVs are nice, though.
Yeah, it's got tremolo and reverb. The tremolo is phenomenal in that thing. I mean, it's just, and it's got a dirt channel. I love the amp. I won't ever part with that thing. Well, cool, man. Any players who have influenced you, Bob, that people would be surprised to hear?
Well, for me, that answer is the usual suspects, you know, the great guitar players in blues and rock. I appreciate them too, but I can't think of any that would be surprising offhand. I enjoy the music of all kinds of people and in many different styles too. There's a lot of styles of blues that I don't know anything about playing, but enjoy listening to.
Musically, if I asked you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order, and knowing this can change tomorrow, what would be your knee-jerk reaction to the first three albums that would come to mind right now?
Well, I would probably have to go to Where My Heart Is, which would say be the albums of Muddy Waters, Jimmy Rogers, and Little Walter, who are all in that one core band together in the early 1950s. Actually had been playing together since before that. I think a lot of people have an affinity for music that came out when they did.
Yeah,
but I do. But that early primitive electric guitar, that style of blues, that the way Muddy and Jimmy were playing together, which they did not have one person playing rhythm guitar and one lead. They kind of the parts kind of the way Keith Richards put it in his book is a good way to put it. He said it's weaving the guitars, and he said that's the Rolling Stones guitar strategy that he does with Ron Wood. However, Muddy, he says it came directly from the Chicago blues that he used to listen to, and that would be people like Muddy Waters and Jimmy Rogers. Those two together, just spectacular. And having gotten to play with both of them and been friends with both of them means a lot to me. Little Walter passed away, I believe, in 1968 or so, and I did not get to see him play, although friends of mine that are contemporary with me did, but I didn't at the time. I know he played in Boston one time, and I heard about the show, but I was playing somewhere else myself at that particular time.
You mentioned how good your parents were. What's the most important thing that your dad taught you?
By example, he was very responsible. He worked very hard to take care of his family and considered that to be his job. And he never sat me down and said, okay, an adult is going to have to do this and that. He just showed me by example that's a good way to do it.
And mom, what's the most important thing your mom taught you?
She was a very loving person, and how to really care for, take care of somebody, and to give and receive love, I would say, would be something that I first experienced from her.
That's awesome, man. And you mentioned your wife a few times. How long is you've been married? A long time.
Well, actually, only since 2004, but we've been together since about 1991 or so.
That's awesome, man.
And yeah, we're pretty tight.
That's a real long time. Congratulations. That's 37 years?
It is about that, but I was already just under 40 around the time that I met her. So
that's congratulations, man. You don't see that too often.
Well, that's why I call romance a battlefield, as it often is.
Well, congratulations. That is a major accomplishment, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It is big deal in my life.
Yeah, it certainly should be, man. Good for you.
And I don't want her to get rained on when she's inside.
Of course. You have any hobbies or interests outside of music, Bob?
Yeah, animals.
Oh, cool. Like pets?
Dogs and cats. Yeah, we have two dogs and two cats. And I had a manager for a while that I was very good friends with, you know, maybe at the end of the last century. And we talked on the phone one time. I said, well, what you up to? She says, oh, I'm just, she lived on a farm. She says, I'm just following the little animals around. And that phrase just really struck me. I said, that's what I want to do, is just go hang out with the dogs and cats and go see what they do.
Yeah.
Play with them. And so every day that I'm home, I do that as much as I can.
Yeah, we have the same. They're very relaxing, aren't they?
Sometimes, sometimes not. But and they don't live as long as us, so you may go through a few generations of them. We have border collies that are really smart and soulful dogs. They know how to love, too. And we've had several generations of them now.
Hey, I'm going to ask you three more questions, and I really appreciate you sharing your story. It's been very interesting.
Thank you.
If you could go back in time and do something different, either business or personally, what would that thing be, if anything?
Well, there were, I probably should have paid more attention to the commercial aspect of my life, because I always just followed my heart. And now I find I have to work harder than ever just to keep going. The world becomes more unfriendly, and it's harder to make a good living playing music. When I got out of Muddy's band, I naively hoped that, hey, I know what I really want to do now that I've been around the world and I've been around the block too. I just want to play blues and bars for soulful people. I don't care about recording. I just hope I can work locally. Hmm. But by the end of, by the middle of the 80s or so, it became harder and harder to do that. And I figured, okay, I better start making some albums and get out on the world scene. So it was probably a mistake not to do that earlier.
Hmm. Yeah.
I might have been that far ahead, because I was out of Muddy's band by 1980, and I didn't record a thing except just recording the band myself off the mixing board from a small PA system I had. But I didn't make any albums at all till I guess the first one came out in 1989 or something. And if I got started with that earlier and started developing my recording skills better, I might have done better, or not.
Yeah, you don't know. Your thing was you just loved the connection, the soulful connection, when you picked up your instrument and people received it.
Yeah, and I thought that by not, going for being rich and famous, which is behind a lot of people's motivations for what they do and who they are, by just saying I want to play the guitar with a band and have and watch people having fun or feeling the music if I'm trying to play something deep and sad. That would have worked for me, and it still would have if it was that easy to do, but can't really do it these days, I don't think. At least I can't.
Yeah. No, I don't think anybody can at all.
Probably somebody somewhere is, and they're probably the ones that are doing it say, damn, I wish I could go somewhere else. But
grass is always greener. Yeah, man. Best advice you've ever been given, and who gave it to you?
Well, I think that situation I talked about with Muddy before, where he said you can't make all the money all the time. Mm. That was pretty good advice right there.
For sure.
It led to some poor business decisions, but nothing that I regret as far as experience and doing the right thing.
Hey, and my last question is, you seem like a super peaceful guy. I mean, I don't know you very well, but I was curious what you
shut up about that.
There you go. What's your definition of happiness?
Well, that goes back to what I said, just being able to be home. I actually find making the music at home to be just as rewarding as doing it in front of people. It's just a more internal process than an external one, but I get to do both, so that's a nice thing. Last week I was in Memphis hanging out with blues people at the award shows and playing at some of the events the night before and the night after, and it was a lot hard work. And on one night it was about four and a half hours on stage.
Wow.
But that was a thrill. But it's really nice to be home and playing with the pets and enjoying my wife's company and just being here. If somebody said to me, "I sentence you to house arrest for the rest of your life," I'll go, "That'll be fine."
Well, I hope you get to do that as long as you want, and I hope you're healthy to do that as long as you want, man. And I really appreciate your time and everything you've done over your career, man. So where can people find you? What's the best places to find you and support you in what you're doing?
Well, I have a website, BobMargolin.com website that will kind of lead to everything significant. That's what it's designed to do. And of course, more in the moment, I kind of show who I am on Facebook or what I'm going to be up to gig wise, and or else just put up a picture of the dogs. I hate that it's been commercialized a lot, and that people get on there and be nasty to each other like it's a game or something.
Oh, on social media? Oh, I know.
Yeah.
It's like kind of insane. I don't really understand that, but whatever. Different strokes for different folks, man. I hear you.
None for me, thanks.
Yeah, man. Hey, listen, I can't thank you enough for your time. Hang on, I'm going to wrap up, but thank you very much for everything. Everybody, please check out and support Bob Margolin. Incredible legacy, incredible player. Watch some of his YouTube videos. You should see him play National Steel Guitar Slide. He's just phenomenal. And check him out online, Bob Margolin. It's BobMargolin.com. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Bob, again, thank you so very much for spending your time here with us. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad the timing worked out. I'm going to Sweden a week from today and playing with a bunch of fine musicians at a two-day festival over there. It'll take 5 days altogether with all the traveling, but it's going to be fun, and I'm really looking forward to it.
That's great, man. I love, there's a ton of good, I've interviewed a bunch of players in Sweden, actually. There's a lot of good, like, guys doing 70s, 80s rock, you know, kind of blues-based stuff, and they're cranking it out, man. It's good stuff there. I hope you have fun.
There's fine musicians everywhere, young and old, and I enjoy working with the young musicians. I've set up some situations where I'll be playing with the band of people that are, you know, in their teens or so, or early 20s, and sometimes, you know, there's some fine South Florida blues people too. It's a young man named David Julia that lives down there. That's really just excellent. He's been playing with his own band in a lot of the clubs and sits in with just about everybody. He goes out every night, and he's so creative and so talented, and just a great player and great artist and a nice person. And we've gotten to be good friends, and we have done some shows together and gonna do more.
That's awesome. I'll look for these, him and that other guy, Mark Evangelos. I'll look for them both if they're coming to town here. Hey, man, thank you again for everything. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it a lot. I hope makes somebody feel good to hear these stories.
Well, I definitely will, man. I can guarantee it. Everyone, thank you for listening. Thanks again to Bob Margolin. Go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes, along with some early product announcements, and get on our newsletter list. It's something you want to do. And this is important. Remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Go play your guitar. Yeah, right? Be nice. Go play your guitar and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.